bounds.
Well, welcome back, everyone. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce our keynote speaker. Roger Kellgren is a professor in the University of Florida Department of Environmental Horticulture and director of the Mid-Florida Research and Education Center. His PhD is from the University of Washington in forestry, and he spent 25 years at Utah State University. While at USU, he focused on plant water use and conservation in irrigated landscapes. Please help me welcome Dr. Kellgren.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here, and particularly those of you hardcore ASHS people who stuck around to today. This talk is a synthesis of my career largely spent at Utah State University, so I do want to honor the wonderful school that it is and my colleagues who I couldn't have done it without them. So, yes, it was a wonderful experience, and I want to honor them too. Okay, tree response to temperature increases from global change will likely vary with hydraulic or hydric properties. This is the world we're creating. This is the world that we're living in from that creation. Increasing temperatures, heat wave frequency, and heat wave duration. And then projected, the years 2035 to 2065, the number of days above 100 degrees are anticipated to increase substantially across the country, but particularly in the south. It is ironic that on talking about the effect of increasing temperatures on plants, that Northern Europe will experience all-time record high temperatures. And we didn't plan it that way, but it is ironic. Okay, four things I want to cover before talking about the implications. The first is that higher temperatures always means higher and drier air. It's the physics. And then the other aspect is that trees are well ventilated. And getting into the technical weeds here a bit, that the boundary layer is at the leaf level, where stalemates have greater control. So the drier air is imposed at the leaf level. And then that ties into stomatal sensitivity to dry air, or high AVPD, a well-recognized phenomenon. And a little bit more recently, how that ties into this whole concept of isohydric and anisohydric behavior in response to dry air and dry soil. Okay, you've all seen this at some point, the temperature water vapor curve, that if you have temperatures at 20 degrees C, you have 1.8 kilopascals of saturated air water vapor in the air. Okay, let's say the relative humidity is 50%. And you trace that over, and then you get an ambient vapor pressure of 0.9 kilopascals, so you have a VPD of 0.9. Okay, most everyone can live with that. But let's say we increase the temperature up to 38 degrees, which is 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Because it's a increasing scale, a logarithmic scale, the saturated vapor pressure is up at 4.5 kilopascals, so a lot drier. And even if the relative humidity stays the same, the vapor deficit increases because the increase in saturated vapor pressure is so high. But it likely happens that the relative humidity is lower in response to the drying air and drops the relative humidity to 20%, then we get a vapor pressure deficit of 3.6 kilopascals. This is basic physics. This is simply well-established basic physics. Point number two, trees are well-ventilated. Unlike a ground-level crop like turf grass or other vegetable crops, trees are up in the air. They're well-ventilated. So that means that the boundary layer is not above the crop canopy. It's at the leaf level. So temperatures and vapor deficits are imposed at the leaf level. And I want to point out the seminal paper for this in 1986 by Jarvis and McNaughton. It was an elegant mathematical explanation of how the boundary layer relates to stomatal conductance, and it describes how plants respond to dry air. A very elegant paper. In 35 years, it's received 300 some citations. That's 10 per year. I'll loop back to this. Okay, point number three. What's happening at the leaf level? So we'll take a sweet gum. Granted, it's a nitrogen deficient, but it's the only picture I had on the underside of a sweet gum leaf. And this is a scanning electron micrograph of the underside of a sweet gum leaf. It's actually quite an entertaining view. And then we have the substomatal cavity down here. And that's where the action takes place. That's where water evaporates. So we have a leaf, we have the underside, we have a close-up of where the stomates are, and evaporation takes place on the walls of this substomatal cavity. And then at saturated vapor pressure of the leaf, and then the water molecules come out through the guard cells, and once they move through the boundary layer, then the water is transpired. So transpiration is simply evaporation in the substomatal cavity moving into outside air. Let's take leaf temperature at 20 degrees C and relative humidity of 50%. Okay, we have a certain number of water molecules bouncing around in there. The guard cells are still open and pushing out into the outside air. Well, let's increase that. And this is a vapor pressure deficit of 1 kilopascal. Let's increase that up to 30 degrees air temperature plus 4 degrees, because leaves are often hotter in when you get up to temperatures that high. So let's add 4 degrees C. And let's say it's 20% relative humidity. The vapor pressure deficit is 4 kilopascals. There are a lot of these guys bouncing around in there. Remember, it is saturated vapor pressure pushing out through the guard cells, and we have a vapor pressure deficit of 3.4 kilopascals. This is getting in the range that a lot of plants don't like this. Mm-hmm. And plants that have aggressive stomatal behavior, they're okay. They can keep pushing out that water. But a lot of plants are conservative. This is a level of dry air that forces the the guard cells to close, are partially closed, and it restricts the flow of water vapor out into the outside air. And so this is also a well-known phenomenon of plants. It was established in the 1980s in Australia and a couple other places about the same time, but it's well recognized. There are many plants that once dry air gets up to a certain point, then the stomates start to close, but not all. So I want to bring in some research that I've worked on, and this is at Utah State University, in conjunction with colleagues at Florida, who's now a current colleague, Richard Beeson, and then Thane Montag at Texas A&M. We had a reciprocal exchange of plants that were grown at all three sites, and we shipped half the plants to the other sites. And I want to just walk through this carefully. This is the only data slide that's this intense. But plants that were grown in Florida and shipped to Utah and Texas, their stomatal opening, their stomatal conductance was equivalent to what it was in Texas, much higher than the plants that were grown in Texas or Florida. And it lasted. That's where the green arrows are. The plant shipped from dry Texas and dry Utah to Florida, their stomatal conductance was quite low. Okay, so something's going on here. But after about 5 days, they acclimated in sync with all of the other trees in these dry climates, and they had the same level of stomatal conductance. It wasn't difference in stomatal density. We measured that. ABA, not really. It just wasn't a clear signal. So there's some things going on we don't quite understand. But what I want to point out is that how dry the air is in Texas and Florida, Texas especially compared to Florida, it doesn't get over 3 kilopascals in Florida, very rarely. Most of the time it's at 2, while in Texas and Utah it is consistently hot and dry, and I would add Las Vegas is really dry and so is Arizona. So let's take this further, and we measured water use of the trees and calculated water use of the plants at all the sites relative to reference evapotranspiration, and calculate the plant factor. And for those who are keeping score, you could call this a crop coefficient too, but I try to avoid that term because these aren't crops. But what it's saying is that in Florida, the water use of these plants relative to reference evapotranspiration was higher compared to Utah and especially Texas. The water use of the plants in Texas were very low compared to reference evapotranspiration. So that means you can't use a single plant factor across all different climates for plants that have stomates that are sensitive to dry air. And so the other take-home point is that species may have aggressive stomatal opening and water use in a humid climate. You move them out of that into a drier climate like global change, where you have higher temperatures and drier air that will often force stomatal closing. Okay, another study I was involved in, this is a PhD student of mine, who brought in 3 maples from across the country, sugar maple, the standard sugar maple, Acer saccharum, and then the local Utah big tooth maple, Acer grandinitatum, and we also brought in the Pacific lowlands big leaf maple, Acer macrophyllum. And this is a leaf that gets up to a foot across. It's really big. Brought them into Utah, grow them under the same conditions, and this is just a representative data sample from one date, about this time of the year in 2009, and we were quite surprised to see that big leaf maple loved it. The hotter it got, the more water it used. Big tooth maple, okay. It's what we expected. It's a dry climate. But the sugar maple, it was doomed. It couldn't open up the stomata enough to take up any carbon or release any water. And within a month, these trees were dead. pH didn't help, but it clearly did not like the dry air. And I want to point out, this is a map showing summer or July vapor pressure deficit in the country. and that the big leaf maple came from the Pacific lowlands up here, very dry, very wet and humid, even in the summer. And then sugar maple follows this exact line of two kilopascals. It doesn't get below this. So it doesn't grow where the temperature is high enough and the air is dry enough that exceeds 2 kilopascals. But I want to point out what it's like here in the desert southwest. There's a reason why you don't see sugar maple here in Las Vegas. It's not only too dry, but it is also really hot. These trees can't even open up their stomates enough to get in any carbon. And this map will change. This is actually from PRISM, the federal agency located at Oregon State University. But the yellow will expand with a hotter world. It simply will, because you get hotter temperatures, degrees over 100. The yellow and the approaching red will expand across the country. Okay, I want to switch gears here to hydric behavior. Isohydric versus anisohydric behavior. So a couple points that hydric behavior is stomatal opening. Again, it's the conservative versus aggressive that regulates internal water tension or water potential as the soil and air dries. So this is a integration of the previous description of what the stomates do in dry air, but brings in dry soil. It's a conceptual framework for understanding differences in water use that have been observed for a long time, and across ecosystems and species, that the variation amongst ecosystems and species is so large. Until this came about, we didn't have a way of really understanding it. And I want to point out another seminal paper by Tardieu and Simoneau in 1998 that was really a catalyst. And I do want to point out that in the 20-some years since this paper was published, it's had 1,000 citations for simply hanging a couple labels on something that was already observed. I will just leave it at that. And this is a number of citations regarding hydric behavior. Vitis vinifera is in there because there's such wide variation amongst grape cultivars in terms of how it uses water. There are some that are extremely aggressive, and they can grow well, for example, in the Central Valley, but there's other types that simply can't function. So it's been sort of the model plant, but you can see over the past 3 years that the number of citations, largely in ecology and forestry, has increased dramatically. And so here's just a working schematic of how the anisohydric and isohydric functions. So an anisohydric species, the stomates stay open longer as the air dries and the root zone dries, but what that means is that internal water tension is going to be much, much greater. So midday, you might have -2 megapascals, which is getting dry, or even -3 if you have a VPD up above about 3 kilopascals. But anisohydric species keep sucking up the water, and they keep the stomates open to take up carbon, and the water is the cost of doing business. This is a competitive advantage. When you have anisohydric behaviors, it's use it or lose it. So it uses it before someone else, some other plant, gets the water. So it's a competitive, I don't want to use the word trait here. It's a suite of physiological processes in response to dry air and dry soil. Isohydric. The stomates close when air or the root zone dries. And what that does is moderate the internal water potential, and it can keep it around 10 bars, 1 megapascal. It's a combination of conservative stomates that close in response to dry air and soil, and keeping the internal water potential at very low levels that won't result in cavitation or embolism. Anisohydric, they're always at the risk of cavitation, a bubble that can kill the plant. But it can extract water down to much drier levels in the soil. This is a very nice schematic of isohydric and anisohydric from Hochberg pretty recently. And the key point is that on a daily basis, if you look at E, which is transpiration, and another way of saying stomatal opening and conductance, that the isohydric species has a mid-morning peak, and then as the air dries over the day, it reaches a mid-afternoon minimum, and it may or may not increase later in the day. As anisohydric, it stays open the whole day. And so it pushes down the water potential, sucking up water to more negative levels. This is where it really plays out, is in soil dehydration. So as the soil dries, the isohydric will start shutting down rapidly transpiration, and that moderates internal water tension much longer into a soil drying. It's the save it until a rainy day approach. Anisohydric, they just keep on going. And they'll use everything they can, and the water potential will decrease accordingly. At some point in here, it all fails. There's a reason why you don't see any, you only see plants like Joshua tree in the Mojave Desert. Nothing else can handle that level of heat in dry soil. So isohydric and anisohydric is useful conceptual framework within a level of dry air and dry soil that can be managed. But when we get to what Vegas experiences on a regular basis and other places may experience, all the plants will fail. All our temperate plants adapted to a drier or wetter climate will fail. I want to bring in a couple more examples of hydric behavior. This is some work I did with some climate colleagues using Pinus edulis and Juniperus osteospermus, so pinyon pine and Utah juniper. These two species are the poster children for the whole anisohydric isohydric concept. There's been a lot of work done it, and particularly focusing on what is the ultimate consequence of isohydric behavior where the temperature gets high enough that the stomates are closed and the plant can't take up carbon. And they coined the term carbon starvation with this. And so this is a study showing, here we have pinyon in the background and Utah juniper in the foreground. And a colleague of mine at Utah State showed that water potential got down to 2 megapascals and it stopped and the trees died. And stomatal conductance decreased accordingly. But for Utah juniper, the kept going to 4.5 megapascals. That's gets to a level that you have to be very careful with a pressure chamber that it doesn't shoot out and skewer your forehead. And it kept the stomates open. So here in the same environment are two species with very contrasting hydric behaviors coexisting. But there's a lot more going on than that, because Utah juniper can survive at a lower and hotter elevation, and they occupy very different root zones. Utah juniper is a very deep-rooted plant. The other thing about Utah juniper, and we did this in a controlled study with lysimeters, and once it gets dry, it will sacrifice parts of the crown. If pinyon pine dries, it gets too dry, it dies. The whole plant simply cavitates and it's gone. Utah juniper will selectively, as an anthropomorphic term that's not quite appropriate, but it parts of the tree will die. And so to sacrifice leaf area to maintain parts of the cambium and phloem and xylem that can keep water pumping up and carbon popping down. And if anyone has been to southern Utah or northern Arizona, you will see these pinyon trees with these fluted trunks that wavy, they may even be flat. It's a consequence of literally 100 or 1,000 years of periodic drought where part of the crown dries and dies, and the part that remains alive is pumping up resources to a much lower leaf area, and then that continues to expand. Okay, another example, part of the study, was comparing it to Rocky Mountain juniper. This is Juniperus scapularum. And that's found in a much more mesic habitat. But they do overlap at their edges. So like a lot of these species, it's not a clear line, it's an overlap. And the Utah juniper was able to maintain open stomates up to 4 kilopascals, extremely dry air, and even when they were drought stressed, this was mild drought stress, kept them open, whereas Rocky Mountain juniper declined somewhat at the higher vapor pressure deficits and definitely the water stress plants. And this is true across the genus. There was a paper about 5 years ago by a lead author named Wilson that showed across all of the juniper species in the West, they all had some degree of anisohydric behavior. So it may be located within a genus, and looking at the maples, sometimes not. So it's not an easy thing to predict in a given species. A recent paper by Klein looked at the difference or across ecosystems and then tree types. The point, the water potential at which there is 50% stomatal closure. And in terms of xylem anatomy, so ring porous and diffuse porous and conifers, the ring porous were able to maintain stomata more open at a lower water potential, which suggests anisohydric behavior. These are things like oak. And indeed, you see oaks in very dry habitats. Diffuse porous, there's simply not enough plumbing between heartwood and then the smaller vessels in diffuse porous species. They can't keep the plumbing up. Conifers, they don't have as much heartwood, and so they have a lot of leaf area, so they can spread the flow of water across a larger area. Across forest types, tropical, seasonal tropical, meaning dry, monsoonal dry forests, and then temperate wet habitats are more or less, or this suggests that they are isohydric. So stomates close at a much less negative water potential, and not that much of a surprise. Plants in a Mediterranean climate and a semi-arid climate then can push things down. That's why they can exist in that kind of habitat. Okay, so a few thoughts about this. When it initially came out, the thinking amongst people looking at this was that hydric behavior was a defined physiological trait of the plant. It's not. It's a suite of traits in response to environmental gradients. And for any given species, these will kick in at different levels of dry air and dry soil. So it's not one specific trait that you can breed for. And it's not drought tolerance. The isohydric species can be more water efficient, and then they can survive longer into drought, but that doesn't necessarily correlate to drought tolerance. And anisohydric species can be found in rainforest habitats, and they can be found in desert habitats. It's simply an adaptive mechanism to use the water before someone else gets it. So they can only be understood, this framework can only be understood in the context of everything else the plant's doing and in the habitat it exists, the particular how dry it is both in air and soil. But there are extremely sensitive isohydric species that are affected by even low vapor pressure deficit. And this category would put citrus, because citrus is a shade plant, and this is true of all shade plants. You put them in full sun, and they're extremely, extremely sensitive. And these species will shut down their transpiration, even at less than 2 kilopascals. Well, as I've shown, that anisohydric species can transpire up to 5 kilopascals of dry air, and then when the soil moisture gets down to 4 megapascals. And interestingly, looking at in the literature at anisohydric species in arid habitats, they always have a fallback position. And this is where I loop back to this notion that there's a lot going on. You can't look at this behavior in isolation. Desert species that have a use-it-or-lose-it behavior are either extremely deep-rooted, they have very, very, very thick sclerophyllous leaves, and they somehow manage to, even when the water runs out, that they're able to maintain the integrity of the foliage. In fact, Utah juniper, there's a suggestion that it can actually siphon water when it rains, scavenge water from the surface soils and move it down deeper into the root zone. Okay, what would this mean with irrigation in a hotter world? When it doesn't get above 100 degrees or 105 degrees, stomatal sensitivity to dry air increases water use efficiency. And this is simple physics, actually, that when you have water vapor out in millimoles, but you have carbon coming in micromoles, you can reduce stomatal conductance and transpiration and not affect the uptake of carbon. And that's the basis of controlled deficit irrigation. Australia, California, it's a widespread practice of mild water stress triggering enough stomatal closure to limit water, but yet yield is not affected. And there's a recent paper, interestingly enough, showing that you can schedule irrigations if you know the hydric behavior of a species based on water potential. That if you have an isohydric plum, a save it until a rainy day species, when water potential pre-dawn, meaning that the soil is dry, gets down low enough, that means it can't go any further. It really needs water. That its mechanisms to try and save it, it's exceeded. You need water. But for anisohydric grape, it's midday, because it doesn't try and conserve water. So you look at midday water potential. So that was very interesting. But I want to come back to this notion that at some point the air gets dry enough and hot enough and the soil gets dry enough that all these mechanisms fail and then the whole ecosystem changes. An example of that is the Sky Islands in the Southwest in Arizona and New Mexico, and a little bit around here, but not quite as much, where they have a lot of pine family members, abies, and not so much the pines, but a lot of abies and chufer and picea maybe. The combination of heat and dry air is pushing these species up in elevation, and there's no place to go. And so specifically, there's a recent study looking at this in Douglas fir that showed, looking at tree rings, so the key to this are tree rings. They can do the correlations with climate, with ring increment, and explain what's going on. What explains a ring increment in a given year? And over the past 4 years, they started to bring in vapor pressure deficit, and sure enough, it is as major of a contributor to limited tree ring growth as drought is. And Restano tied vapor pressure deficit directly to limited growth in Douglas fir around the probably the Pacific Northwest. But it will affect a lot of these trees are adapted to higher elevations. As it gets drier, they get more stressed. You get a lot of bugs. There's a lot of borers that's wiping out the subalpine fir in the Mountain West. So it's a combination of dry air and dry soil, but you can't separate the two of them. They're linked. If you have hotter temperatures, you have drier air, and there will be more water loss from the soil. And another dimension of this is that there may be some benefits to global warming, both in terms of boreal habitats, it will be warmer and trees will grow better up there because it's warmer. They're not limited by cold. Not so much. Peter Reich, very well-known ecologist, just published on boreal forests that they increased the temperature and everything dried out. And the trees didn't grow. So, yes, in a boreal habitat, it will be warmer, but it's unlikely to see any benefit in growth. And then there's talk of carbon fertilization with that higher CO2 has an inhibitory effect on stomatal opening, so it's like deficit irrigation. You restrict the stomatal opening, but you increase the gradient of carbon. There's been no consistent results, and sure, in some isohydric species and some herbaceous species, there may be a carbon fertilization effect, but in isohydric or isohydric-prone ecosystems, no, it won't. And if it gets hot and dry enough, carbon fertilization will have no effect. 40 million years ago at the Eocene, Miocene era, there was a temperature maximum that it got up to 1,000 parts per million carbon. And the fossil record shows that the plants got smaller and the leaf sizes much, much smaller. So it's a bit of a model for how plants will adapt to it. It's going to be very hot and dry, and at some point they can't acclimate. There has to be a genetic adaptation. Do we have enough time for it? I'm not going to go into that. And just one last point is that I just don't see this in the literature, but that leaf size is going to play a huge role in this. Try taking a big leaf maple and putting it in Las Vegas. No. You put it out and one day it'll be toast. Leaf size is a huge effect for isohydric species, because if they close their stomates, the swamp cooler effect goes away. And so they get really hot, so that increases the leaf-to-air vapor pressure gradient, and it gets worse. Now, that said, for obligate and isohydric species, yes, it's an issue, but there is a model out there in the deciduous dry forests in the tropical regions, the monsoonal dry forests, where they have large leaf species that become totally defoliated. And this picture is in Thailand in a dry deciduous forest where they totally defoliate. I haven't seen work on it, but my guess is that once they start hitting the dry season, they dry out, ABA and water stress will close the stomates, and the temperature of these really large leaves will shoot way up, and then even further triggering ABA and then potential senescence of the leaves. So there is a possible mechanism out there where large leaves can be an advantage if you have a drought or species that can adapt in a drought deciduous way. So I think I'm right about 35 minutes, so thank you very much. And if anybody has any questions, there are microphones here. This may seem really nerdy, but this is fun stuff. I really enjoy it. Yeah, if you could.
I noticed a very interesting phenomenon in the Canary Islands in Spain, with a species, I think it's called Pinus canariensis.
My hearing is not very good. Could you?
Okay. I noticed a very interesting response of a tree. It's a Pinus canariensis in Canary Islands.
Ah, okay.
You know, this species is very interesting because as you start going uphill from the coast area towards up, it starts to be present.
It starts to become what?
It appears in the landscape.
Yeah.
Okay? But the local folks were commenting that plants at certain altitude were starting to die, and they didn't know why.
So the observation is that Canary Island pine grows at a certain elevation, correct? And it's starting to die at the lower edge? It's probably the increased temperature. It's again, the mountains around here, not with the pine forest, but with the abies and the picea species, they're dying. They're simply dying. There's no place else for them to go. So, yeah, and it's related at some level. It's not everything, but it's related at some level to isohydric behavior, that it gets too hot and too dry.
I wanted to just thank you for your presentation. In the Four Corners area where I'm residing, we're experiencing mass die-offs of mountain
Of which species?
As you mentioned, we're experiencing mass die-offs of coniferous forest. These forest fires are getting more intense. And I really appreciate your talk and bringing this to the spotlight. And I think we should go back to our policymakers with this information and really try to, lobby, use the science, and Again, thank you for your talks.
Are these ponderosa pine forests?
It's just, like Wolf Creek Pass. It's a fir species.
Oh, okay.
But even just driving around and noticing these changes, a lot of tree stress.
Okay.
Again,
the observation in the Four Corners region that certainly Douglas fir, it doesn't tolerate drought well. It definitely has an elevation level, and you start pushing up the temperature, doesn't do well.
I had a question about the adaptation of C3 to C4 and how that affects the isohydric behavior of grasses. Could you kind of hold forth a little bit about the C4 and how it really does make them a lot more efficient.
Could you repeat the part about how what affects the...
How C4 affects the hydric
behavior. Okay. Yeah, so the question is how does C4 is intrinsically more water efficient in terms of being able to scavenge carbon. There are a few C4 trees. I don't know that there's very many of them. They're mostly herbaceous and plants in the Atriplex now, the goosefoot family. But they're already in extremely dry habitats. So they are probably the ones, so the C4 plants that are already herbaceous, they'll probably do well for a long time. And then the shrubs too. The C4 grasses, they will probably do very well too. I know they're trying to find the magic C4 gene and, is it a wild goose chase? I don't know. But definitely the C4 species will be able to do better. These are all the three C3 species. And within that, that's about the extent that I can speak to the C4. Could you come up and...
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Mary from Obafemi Awolowo University in Nigeria. I just want to provide further information concerning the C4 plants. C4 plants, they have the ability to absorb carbon dioxide in the night.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the C3, that it absorbs carbon dioxide in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And the process of stomata opening, water is lost.
You're talking about C4 or CAM plants?
C3 plants.
Yeah.
Only absorbs carbon dioxide in the afternoon. And because of this, it loses water through photosynthesis, through the stomata into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Whereas the C4 plants are capable of preserving their water in the afternoon and now absorb carbon dioxide in the night or in the evening, thereby compensating, especially during the dry season or when the water is in short supply. So that is one of the mechanisms that they are using. And that is why it is considered to be more, they have a higher advantage over the C3 plants.
Thank you. Yeah. There's so much going on. You can't break it down to a simple, this is how all plants respond. They won't. There's so much going on. Even within the isohydric, anisohydric framework, there are the C4 plants, and then there's the CAM plants that are adapted to it. So this is just one peek, mostly at horticultural and forest trees, but it's an issue larger than us, and it's stepping back far enough to get the big picture is the only answer. I stepped back this far. There's that much to go. Thank you.
If there are no other questions, help me thank Dr. Kellgren for his presentation.
Thank you, and congratulations. I had a colleague who's going to retire in 2 years, and he said, yep, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah. So mine wasn't planned very far ahead.
Yeah.
there's no point in lingering longer. I'm going to be 300 years there, and then I'm going to end up with it. So I have a specific goal, I'm happy to leave it to someone else.
Do you think there is a relationship between silent diameter in
Partially. Yeah, because like a ring porous species has heartwood once it gets big enough.